Forensic Psychology is a podcast that provides an illuminating window into the workings of the criminal mind. Now, here's your host, Dr. Carlos.
Welcome back, everybody. Welcome back, Andy.
Hey, Carlos, how are you? I'm doing great.
Well, you know what? It's a good end for 2022, I have to say, because they arrested that suspect. That's what we're going to be talking about today, folks. The Idaho murder suspect, Brian Koberger. So we'll be talking about that case. I know you're going to be talking about process. If you don't know Andrew Bringle, you can find out more about him at Behavioral Science Unit, LLC.com. But he's a former FBI profiler and a judge. So we're going to get a lot of inside information here. Not inside information, a lot of insight is what I wanted to say. A lot of insight into this process of how this all unfolded. Andy, I know we're limited for time, so we'll just get to the go here.
I just want to make a quick disclaimer, Carlos, in that we're not going to speculate in terms of innocence or guilt of any particular individual. Anyone arrested, anyone that is a subject or suspect in this investigation is deemed or is considered innocent until proven guilty. And the person that has been named in the media by the police department and the DA's office out of Idaho is certainly presumed innocent until all evidence is put forth in a court of law. So we're not going to talk about that. We're going to talk about the processes of the investigation and a couple of things that have come out of this investigation because of its national interest. So I just wanted to say that because we're going to focus more on judicial process, investigative process, and some of the ancillary issues that have come about because of the interest in of this investigation. And I think all of those are very interesting topics.
No, they are. What I'm going to do is just tell you what so far the media has said. This is open source information. Sure. This does not mean he's guilty, folks. Does not mean he's not guilty. We have no idea. But like as Andy said, innocent until proven guilty. And the latest thing that I just read now is that his family was worried because of his bizarre eating habits, but they didn't say anything about it except they had dietary restrictions. That really doesn't tell us much about anything because if they were meat eaters and he was a vegan, which is what they're claiming he was, that means nothing. I've known people who eat meat who think vegans are weird, and people who eat meat, they think they're weird. So it doesn't tell me much of anything there. The thing that did start make me a little interested, this is not, again, not saying that he is the suspect, because I mean, he did it, that his uncle had to buy new pots and pans because he would not eat anything that had ever had meat in them. That is not super weird. They say he seemed very OCD. Just because of that, I've seen that before with other people. It could be religious reasons. Who knows? There's a whole host of things there. So again, I'm just trying to make sure people don't jump to the gun or conclusion because the media is going to try to hype this up like there's no tomorrow. Because they define OCD and try to correlate it already with that one sentence. And OCD has criteria. OCD has duration. And those are things you don't know. Yes, I'll let you talk about that. Or you want me to talk about that, Andy?
Go ahead.
Well, Andy was doing, he was telling me right now that records indicate Koberger was a doctoral candidate. So this is something you can see in the New York Post in criminal justice at Washington State University. And Andy and I have talked about this before. Maybe you confirm this. We've seen people who have been convicted. This is guys, we don't know what he's innocent or guilty yet, but the people who have been convicted, we've seen a few of them actually get involved in cases themselves. This is a little different scenario because he's actually going through, he's studying it. So for whatever reason he studied it, I don't know what his agenda was. But he was a doctoral candidate in criminal justice at Washington State University. He was planning to study that the emotional and psychological conditions of would-be criminals. That was according to DeSalle University, where he got his master's. It was an email tied to a cryptic Reddit post. Amazing how much they can access when somebody. They found him because the white Hyundai Elantra was matched to the description that the investigators were looking for. They found him over in Pennsylvania, which probably all of you know by now. They are saying The crime scene at the time of the murders was also confiscated from the scene of his arrest. His DNA had also been matched, has also been matched to samples recovered at the scene of the deaths. But we've seen this before too. Just because it was there doesn't mean he did anything. So we really don't know that yet. So those are just some of the things that I've seen right now. The doctoral candidate does make me wonder a little bit what was going on there.
Let's talk about the process. Well, first of all, let's start, you know, very beginning with
let me finish this real quick. My thought, the mental health issues that I was looking at, because his ability to complete a master's program and go into a doctorate program is pretty intense. You only got about 5 or 6% of the U.S. that has a doctorate. So for him to be able to do that makes me wonder if he has a mental health condition. It's definitely not going to be psychosis. At least not for that reason. He's gone through a lot of education, unless he developed it now. He's 28 years old. I mean, very possible could have developed some kind of schizophrenia at the end, but I don't know.
And doctor, isn't that a little late though for schizophrenia?
It can, but you know, not everything works so, you know, nice and cut.
Like a clockwork. Yeah.
Yeah. So
there's a lot going on. As you know, getting your PhD is very stressful. And there's not just mental health and mental illness, but there's also emotional illness as well. And you look at you know, those types of topics of motive, emotional and psychological motive for violent crime. And you could be I hate the term sucked in, but you could be seduced by it in the sense that if your fascination is how do people get away with crimes of those types.
And I was looking at it, his ability mentally to handle it, his discipline, because that certain mental health issues, it's really difficult to be able to go through school and be able to last, because you don't have the discipline and the attention to do it. So it kind of rules out a lot of several mental health issues. It'll be curious. You don't have to have a mental health issue.
I'm not even tying it back to this particular individual. Let's go back to the process. I mean, you know, what was interesting about the news conference was the Chief Fry went back and talked about the beginning of the investigation from the patrol officers, the first responders to the crime scene, and how good a job they did in containing that crime scene. Now, we know it was contaminated because the two surviving roommates called some people over. These are the facts that were, you know, an open source. And it's very difficult. I've been to a number of crime scenes. It's very difficult to make sure that it's secured and contained so that there isn't contamination. It was vital in this case because of the type of scene that has been reported. Four victims brutally murdered, blood everywhere, blood literally leaking out of an outside door into the outside of the house. Again, reporting from the news media, open source information from the police, that at least two of the victims had defensive wounds, indicating that they fought back. And again, we talked about this, that just in general terms, when you stab someone, it's not an instant death. The person is going to fight back, right? And even if you're attacked while you're sleeping, you're waking up because you've been stabbed and you're going to fight back. And it's highly likely that the subject, as we've stated in the past, was injured or during the defense of one of the victim gouged or scratched or somehow pulled hair, and there's DNA at the crime scene. So, of course, DNA in the crime scene, you know, that happens quite a bit, but you have to be able to compare it. So when we're looking at forensic evidence at a murder scene, and people say, oh, DNA, and they think about, you know, what they've seen on TV, you still need something to compare it to. A fingerprint is the same thing. You need something, someone to compare it to. So the investigation continued well beyond the collection of that forensic evidence. We also talked about, and the police chief, Chief Fry mentioned, the number of tips that was received. Now, there were three agencies working this investigation primarily. There was Moscow PD, Idaho State Police, and the FBI. They had over 19,000 tips that had to be triaged. 19,000. Now, I know it's been 7 weeks, but think about the math. Right. And a very small department, even with the resources that were additional from the FBI and the state police. And I've worked these types of cases, the Centennial Bomb in 1996, the killing of a federal judge in 1989, and several others. that even with 20, 30, 40 people working full time, that's still a small group when you're talking about 19,000 investigative tips. Over 300 interviews.
What do you think? How many do you think of those 19,000? I know it's a complete guess on your part, but how many do you think were actually good? Was it like 5%, 10%?
It's interesting. We're talking about processes, right? So similarly, a federal judge was killed in 1989, blown up by a bomb. We've talked about it in previous shows. It was the Van Pack investigation. Judge picks a Christmas present, right? In 1989. And bomb goes off, kills him instantly, maims his wife. I don't know, there were 100 FBI agents and local police and state police looking for the killer at that time. And you go through thousands and thousands of leads, investigative leads, and you don't know what's going to break the case open. In that particular case, and I was lucky to be part of that, I found some nails that were used in the bomb that helped us identify the suspect who eventually became the subject in the investigation, convicted. Walter Leroy Moody. But the point being is that every one of these cases, there is a break. There's this, you know, there's this piece of evidence that unravels and, you know, is that break in the case. I find that process the most fascinating part of any investigation. Mm-hmm. It can be an interview. It can be a forensic piece of evidence. Typically, it's two or three things tied together and that makes one major break in the investigation. That is what the Chief Fry was talking about when he was talking about, asked by the press, what was the break in the case? He says that'll come out because under Idaho Supreme Court ruling, they have to seal the facts of the case until he's made an appearance in the state of Idaho and been formally arraigned there. So you're going to hear the facts come out in this. And the chief mentioned that, right? But the tone, I was reading his body language. I was reading and listening to his tone and looking at his facial expressions, both verbal and nonverbal behavior of the chief indicates to me he's fairly confident that their investigation has been thorough and successful, at least to this point. Now, going back to that pivotal piece of evidence, it will be interesting for me to see what that is. It could be because he mentioned, and again, this is open source. We're not talking about a particular individual. He talked about the murder weapon not being found yet. So he's made a further appeal through the media to the public, right? So it's an interesting, this is me talking, right? This is what I find fascinating in these cases is the interplay between the police that need the media and need the public, but how that relationship has to be at arm's length because there are so many people like you and I that, you know, have access to a microphone and the internet, and they're just espousing whatever they believe and accusing people that have nothing to do with this case of the most horrendous acts, defaming them and slandering them all the same. And the chief wants to avoid that. At the same time, he needs the public to help them try to identify the murder weapon because they don't have it. So there's this kind of catch 22, if you will, where he needs them, but he doesn't want them, but there's a risk of using them. But the cost benefit is such that he has to rely on the public's, you know, see something, say something. Kind of thing that results in 19,000 tips. To your question, if 10% of those are legitimate, that's 1,900, right?
A lot, yeah.
If 1%, it's almost 200 leads. If 1% are good leads, and the fact of the matter is, it's probably just one or two leads that led them to the break in the case. Now, my math's not that good, so I don't know what that is, but
0.001 or something.
Yeah, 300 interviews, Carlos. Imagine that, 300 interviews in 7 weeks. Do that math, right? What's 7 into 30? It's like 200, it's like, I don't know, 20-something. It's a lot. But my point is, that's what they're going through. The police have done, I think, a very good job of husbandry work of marshaling out the leads when they needed them. There was a lot of criticism to, you know, in the process. And I've been, you know, in these investigations where similar criticism has occurred. There you go. I'll give you another case. It was a kidnapping case. Young woman was kidnapped. bad guy actually made a ransom call. And the special agent in charge, okay, it was a local police department, very small police department, Haleyville, Alabama. And the local police department calls the FBI in. The SAC, who's now working with the chief of police, but the chief is relying on the FBI heavily. He's got the recorded ransom demand from the bad guy. Now, we're in the process of trying to catch the bad guy. And there was a big debate among the managers. Should they release the audio of the demands from the kidnapper? Because if they do, then the kidnapper knows that we have that information, that evidence. And he's been telling the victim's family, you better not go to the police. Right. And if that happens, now that he knows that he's been recorded and his voice, so now he kills the young lady. That was the fear. At the same time, we had no real leads as to where who the bad guy was. So you need the public to help identify the bad guy. Now you're in the situation, you're the special agent in charge. And the question is, do you release the audio tape and hope that somebody's, hey, that's somebody I know, and take the risk that he kills the victim? Or do you hold it close to the vest in hopes that you identify the bad guy by other means?
That's a great point. That's a tough one, huh?
It's a tough one, right? So here's what happened. So the SAC and the chief of police decided not to release it for a period of about 8-9 days. They didn't release it till we ran about every lead we could down, and still we didn't have the victim in our custody or the bad guy. So they made the decision to broadcast the audio tape. Within hours, Carlos, within hours, a relative called and said, that's my uncle. Bland was his first, his last name, Jerry Bland. And he was guilty. He was the perpetrator. He was the kidnapper. Unfortunately, he had killed the victim before the release of the audio. His accomplice, and that's another aspect of this other investigation, but is whether or not there's an accomplice. And in that case, there was an accomplice of kidnapping. Her name's Sherry McPherson, a cousin of Jerry Bland's, and she's in jail, life without parole. But had that tape not been released, then the public would not have come forward. Many of these cases, in fact, most FBI big investigations include informants or cooperation from the public. All the way back to John Dillinger, the woman in red, actually she was in an orange skirt, but she was a cooperating informant. And, you know, John Gotti in the Gambino case. I mean, he was the integral part of helping put John Gotti in jail. So it'll be interesting. Again, we're talking about process to figure out how this process in Idaho has gone, the investigative process in terms of the big break in the case. Right. That to me is going to be an interesting part of this investigation as it comes out. And according to Chief Fry, he says the affidavit will be released. The factual probable cause has to be sealed until he's brought back to Idaho to stand and for these charges. You and I have talked about the process leading to a crime. And you probably remember when we talk about motive, we're talking about PEPs.
Mm-hmm. Yep, right? PEPs.
So, you know, we can look at that model, personal, economic, power, political, or social, and you can overlay that in this particular case. You and I, at least I won't speculate, but our listening audience can, and they can kind of start defining what the possible motive might have been based on what they're hearing from the police. And I think that's another interesting aspect of this investigation. I also think what's going to be interesting in this investigation is the collateral damage done. We have heard from open source that there might have been at least one person targeted, and we'll find out. That's part of that, you know, motive. You know, if it's a personal motive and there was a targeted attack because of a relationship, associate of a relationship, or a more primary relationship. But aside from that, I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the collateral damage in the general community. There was a professor, I don't know what school, she might have been at the Idaho State, who was defamed by a TikTok personality.
Mm, that's right.
Who was reading in tarot cards that this female professor was guilty. And there's been a lawsuit filed. There was a person of interest, as they say, who was cleared by police, and police were, you know, made that very clear, who was harassed online again and again. There were several, actually, from, I think, an ex-boyfriend to a guy at a food truck. And the thing is, you have a lot of these amateur sleuths that have absolutely no access to the facts of the investigation, which doesn't prevent them from speculating and calling out individuals. And it leads to the point that I'm going to make, which is, and I've done this work. I've been the case agent in these types of, you know, investigations. And whether it's, you know, white collar public corruption investigation or a bombing of a judge. And circumstantially, there are individuals that may look like this is the guy. We got him. This is it. And it turns out it's not the case. There was a guy in the VanPack investigation. You and I talked about this in the past, who was had a little picking shop. You know, he had like an antique shop at his home in South Alabama. I think his last name was McFarland. The evidence looked like this guy had the typewriter that was used to write a letter to Judge Vance. And the FBI goes and does their job, right? They go down and they execute a search warrant looking for this typewriter, even excavate his septic tank because they think that he broke it, you know, apart and put it down in there. And turns out he had nothing to do with it. There was a guy named Richard Jewell who was part of the Centennial Bomb. And of course, they made a movie about the dude because, listen, he was, again, the media made his life hell. He had nothing to do with the bombing at Centennial Park. And of course, later led to a lawsuit. Oftentimes, it's not unusual that the circumstantial evidence leads investigators and or the general public to the wrong individual. And that's why we have to be very careful presuming innocence. Until all the facts are in.
No, that's the sad thing. And today, you mentioned it just before we started the interview that a lot of people jump on this because they can get clicks, it makes them money, and they know it makes them money. And it's a sad reality we live in. But folks, I guess my point is make sure, wait for all the facts to come out. I already saw two things come out already that he enjoyed killing people. He wanted to see them suffer. They have no idea.
Right.
That's not released anywhere. He hasn't said anything about it. I highly doubt he will. So we have no idea what's going on out there. So, you know, just be careful with speculation and conjecture. And people are going to say a lot of things because they know it's going to get them visitors to their site and they're going to make them money.
Well, here's another interesting part or point. So, and this is procedural. So they as you mentioned, evidently they have somebody in custody, right? That's known fact. The affidavit will eventually be released. The individual has the right. He's already made one appearance in Pennsylvania. Next Tuesday will be set for his preliminary hearing where the state has to lay out some of the facts. And then the individual can either waive extradition or he can say, I'm not waiving my extradition. He's from the state of Pennsylvania. And they, from the process standpoint, he would then have to force the process of extradition, which could take, you know, could take several days to several weeks. Here's the point. The public wants all the information now. The media wants to be the outlet that breaks the information now. There's a process in place that has to be respected. And this judicial process, now that it's moved into the court system, has to be done with due diligence, with the care and the respect that we give every defendant that's in the court system. And so one thing that I thought was interesting from the whole statement made by Chief Fry, and this will get played, believe me, in the media. He did an excellent job, I thought, in the press conference. Much of the time when asked about particulars in the investigation, he said that's part of the investigation. It'll come out in the future. But at one point he was asked, or they were asked, do you feel like the community is safe? And he says, I think we have a person in custody who committed this horrible crime. Now, that speaks to me about confidence.
Yeah.
And we don't know what the where that confidence comes from. But as I was looking at the process and the chief speaking, I was interested in just how much information he was willing to release. And he did. He didn't, except for the fact that they don't have the murder weapon in this investigation. He did not release a lot of information. Another interesting point, though, he did bring up that the house was being cleaned of evidence, I assume, and remediation, because, you know, the house is a, you know, school's back in pretty soon. They use the house.
Hey, Andy, can they convict without a murder weapon?
Again, we're talking about, you know, rules of evidence and investigations and court process.
Just in general.
Yes, you can. You can be convicted of a crime without a murder weapon. So that is possible.
Does it make it much more complicated? Or?
Well, it would certainly be cleaner if you had a murder weapon and that you could identify. And then, but here's the other part. You have to tie that murder weapon to the individual. Just because you have a murder weapon and the individual has, you know, can say that I never owned that knife. So, again, looking at and this is the other part of this investigation I thought was fairly interesting, is that it's not just the DNA. We focus on DNA because of, you know, Hollywood and all that good stuff. But there's a lot of other things that they'll be looking at, particularly now that they have got, you know, a focus subject in this investigation. They're going to look at the vehicle. They're going to rip that vehicle apart, looking for hair fiber, looking for DNA, looking, you know, in terms of blood, looking for any type of evidence that ties it back to the helm. They're going to be looking for DNA, of course. They're going to be looking at bank records. You know, in these investigations, one of the things you're going to do is look at a bank record to see if that tracks. They're going to be looking at the car's GPS, if that car that they found at that home, that's similar to a car they were looking for. They'll be trying to track that car through its GPS to see if it was at the victim's home at the time of the killing. Of course, they're looking for the knife. They'll be looking at the knife. They'll be looking at the phone records. They'll be comparing all of this to the statements made, if there were statements made. Remember, the defendant in our system of justice doesn't have to make any statements. From the media, evidently he made one statement to the media or to the police as they were arresting him. He said, is anybody else arrested? Again, in terms of just the process, that information, that statement will be used by investigators, and it could mean something. It may not mean anything at all.
Interesting comment, though.
Well, what, you know, then people are speculating. What would that possibly mean? Is there, you know, obviously the knee jerk is, if he says, is anyone else, have you arrested anyone else? Then there must be an accomplice, right? And several people have speculated all along that the type of crime that was committed, it'd be difficult for one person to commit it by themselves.
Or the suspect would be placing at least doubt in everybody's mind.
There you go. So maybe a suspect is or subject is doing that to create leverage for future negotiations. One of the things we're talking about, processes and law, Idaho does have a death penalty.
Oh, it does.
It does have a death penalty. And so, you know, that's in play, obviously. And I don't know all of the processes, all of the stipulations for a death penalty case in Idaho, but I imagine they charged the charges that have been outlined, the four murders, first degree, but also a burglary charge. And a lot of states require for a death sentence to have the murder, premeditated murder, be part of another crime or in furtherance of another crime. So the burglary charge may have something, or there may be other charges that come down. Again, I don't, you know, we only know what's being reported by the media, and that came from the police department, Chief Fry. You know,
so the last execution, by the way, the last execution in Idaho was in 2012.
Yeah.
And in 2011, they were done by lethal executions. Those are the last two, and they have a 8 death row inmates as of April.
Yeah.
2022. Just to give you ideas there.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, there's a lot going on there. If I were a smart individual, you know, I would know, you know, my background is in criminology. I would know what the laws are of the state I lived in and what the repercussions of violating those laws would be. So we'll leave it at that on that point. But, you know, here's the thing. The facts in this case are sealed at this point. By law, they have to be. The chief has promised transparency when the court proceedings start. And so I imagine that it'll be in the next week or so, there'll be much more information coming out. My hope is that in the interest of knowledge, we don't trump the interest in justice. And that people leak information that shouldn't be, that would somehow cause a problem with the investigation or the administration of justice in this case. I think that more than anything is what's owed to the four victims and the victims' families.
That would be a tragedy.
I would also say that, again, being part of some of these types of investigations, unfortunately, in the past, the work done by the Moscow Police Department, the Idaho State Police, the FBI, in a collaborative role, just tremendous, tremendous, considering it, you know, people say it's been 7 weeks. This is not a 1 hour episode of 48 hours, right? This is not a 2 hour movie with Brad Pitt as the lead. This is real life. And when you let that sink in, a very difficult investigation to date. It's long from being over. In fact, I think the chief said this is the beginning. There'll be a lot more than those 19,000 leads. He's asked for the public, an appeal, to give more information about the individual that they have in custody. I imagine that that's going to resonate, and you're going to get a lot of information. If you remember the Richard Jewell situation, you remember that after
the Olympics and the bomber and all that? Yeah.
Right. So with Richard Jewell, I mean, the media hounded the guy. And I imagine that the media is going to be very vigilant in their pursuit of the story. And I hope that that's in pursuit of the truth.
And our objective is really just to make sure that we.
Oh, you blanked out there just a second there.
Oh, yes. My microphone went out. Our goal is to give you guys the right information and to highlight when people are just being hyperbolic, using clickbait, so you don't get misled.
Yeah, and I think we want to educate our audience the best we can. But more importantly, in these cases, we want to be mindful of two things. First and foremost, we want to be sensitive and empathetic to the victims' families and the victims themselves. Horrific, horrific case. And these four beautiful lives have been lost forever. At the same time, we want to be conscious and considerate of the system of justice, be respectful of that system, and make sure that the defendant gets every right due to them in a court of law. And that's, I think, as important as anything that we pursue, because it is the basis of our system. And so I think that's where it's a good place to leave it, right? Is it, it was a good day for Idaho, a good day for Moscow, a good day. I think one of the victims' fathers said this is the first happy day he's had in 7 weeks. Hmm. So the families feel closure in some sense at this point. Today was the memorial for two of the victims, right? Wow. Tonight. So my heart's and my prayers goes out to the victims and the victims' families and the community in Moscow. My hope is that justice is served properly. You know, the police are doing their work, and the media is doing their work. And, you know, I just make sure that the rights of the accused are also respected, and he's given proper day in court.
That's good. All right. We'll wrap it up here, folks. Thank you again for listening. We'll keep you updated as we get more information every week on the Idaho murders, and we'll cover other topics as well. But if we see anything pertinent coming up in the next few days or anything like that, then we'll let you know on that.
Well, we want to get back to our psychology of romance. I got some ideas. We got to get back to something a little more light and less heavy than murder. And
I don't think anybody here has listened to that one, but you never know. You never know. They have to have romance, don't they?
Our psychology. People love our psychology of romance series. Yeah, I get comments all the time.
I'm not sure if the criminal, well, I guess everybody's got to have a little.
Oh, everybody, even criminally, you know, interested.
Blind individual.
Yeah, whatever. People that listen to crime, true crime, they believe me, they like romance too. They flip the channel from Hallmark over to Crime ID or whatever that show.
Oh, ID, yeah, Investigative Discovery.
That's it. That's right. They go back and forth. I know it.
All right, folks. Thanks for listening. Make sure to share, subscribe, and hit that like button. Be safe out there.